Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Napalm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to a special run of guest-hosted episodes of I Was There Too, the show where normally I talk to people who were there in the great and interesting moments of film history. But for the next 2 months, I'm stepping aside to let a handful of special people take over the hosting duties, because I'm off getting married and honeymooned. So I'll be back directly. But until then, this run of shows, both in the guests as well as the hosts, will be some really, really great stuff. How do I know? Because I know who the guests are, and I know who the hosts are. And I will be listening to the interviews as they come just like you, and I can't wait. So today, I give you one of my very best friends, Mark McConville, speaking to Michael Ensign, the snooty hotel manager from Ghostbusters, Titanic, Superman, and many other films. Stay subscribed, write a review of this show on iTunes if you can, and if you ever want to dig back into the archives to hear great episodes like Stephen Tobolowsky, the needle-nosed insurance salesman from Groundhog Day, or Phil Lamar, poor backseat head-wound Marvin from Pulp Fiction, just visit Stitcher Premium or Howl.fm. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon. Enjoy.
The film, Ghostbusters. The year, 1984. The role, hotel manager. The actor, Michael Ensign.
I looked up a lot of information about you on the internet, which is always factual. There's never anything wrong. And the first thing I saw was Safford, Arizona. You're born
not
in...
that arrest in Waco?
I didn't catch that.
I was born in a little town called Safford, Arizona.
And were you raised there?
No.
No.
We left when I was very small.
Okay.
We ended up in another very small little town in Arizona called Scottsdale. And it was very small at that time. And now it's mammoth. And then I spent the first early years of my life in the Phoenix area.
Sure.
And I decided that I looked at being an actor very early on.
How early would you say?
12.
Oh, you know the exact age?
Absolutely. Because
all right.
I was a fat kid. I wasn't any good at anything. I was no sports star. I hated sports. I wasn't very smart in school.
Okay.
And, you know, and I got picked on.
Sure.
But when I was 12, we were living in Phoenix, and at the little local church where we attended, they had something called a road show, which was a little Mormon thing that they would put on these little shows, and they would tour around to the various other little Mormon congregations.
All right.
And put them on. So I got cast in some kind of Noah's Ark epic. And I went out on the stage dressed as a fat purple rabbit. And I got a lot of laughs, and I decided that's it. I was walking home, that's it. I'm going to be an actor.
You and I have a lot in common. It's a very similar story for me. I had a very similar experience too, yeah.
And so from that point on, it was just a question of, okay, how do I do this? Because that was nowhere in my DNA, nowhere in my food chain was anybody doing this or had done it.
Right. No one in your family is a performer of any kind or?
Nope.
No.
So I was on my own. Fortunately, I went to a high school, first Scottsdale High School, and then to Arcadia High School when it was built in Phoenix. And the high school drama teacher was extraordinary, John Hall, who had a master's in scenic design from University of Washington. He could have been teaching at any college or university, but he liked teaching in high school.
Right.
So he was very, very professional. So from a very, very early time, I was set a professional standard. They always did a major musical. Now, when I say major musical, the first one I was in was The King and I. And the woman who sang, if you know the show, the woman who sang the head wife eventually went on to the Metropolitan Opera.
Oh, wow.
The woman who sang Anna, the lead, eventually ended up touring in the national tour of Nona Nanette. The girl who danced the ballet in King and I went on to New York City Ballet. This standard, this kind of standard in Scottsdale, Arizona. And they would bring in, to help the kids in the orchestra, they would actually bring in people from the Phoenix Symphony to play with them.
Oh, wow. So you had some serious mentorship.
Oh, yeah.
Both on stage and in the orchestra pit. That's amazing.
And so it was, and that was the way it was with him. And then he moved over to Arcadia High School at the time. It was built. It had the best equipped stage in the state of Arizona. The Arizona Republic used to come and review the productions.
Oh, wow.
And so that was my intro in high school to all of this stuff.
Sure.
Then he left. Then I went on to do anything that I could do in Phoenix, Phoenix Children's Theater, eventually to the Phoenix Little Theater, which is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, little theaters in the United States.
Right.
It had its own very nice theater built,
sure,
custom
sure.
built. And so I did that. And then, okay, college is coming up. What do I do now? What do I do now? And then I had some friends who had been to connected with the University of Utah. And they convinced me I should try to go there. They had an excellent theater department. Mm-hmm. Again, very high professional standards.
Sure.
They just built a brand new theater, the Pioneer Memorial Theater. I was in the second production on that stage. And what they would do, they would bring in guest artists for every production, some pretty big stars.
Uh-huh.
And so I had a chance to work with them. And then eventually, like my senior year, my scholarship was to be in the company and I was paid for acting.
Oh, that's great.
So I got the professional idea in my head. Then at the end of that, I said I wanted more training. So I went on to apply to three places that actually took me. Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts, NYU, and Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. So I was seeing the Jews, the Catholics, and the atheists. And the Catholics came through with the best offer.
All right.
So for a year of graduate study, I did some of the classwork, but mainly I toured with their classical touring company.
Okay.
And we were doing Midsummer Night's Dream and a very truncated version of the Oresteia, and in two Chrysler station wagons and a big truck.
Oh. Yeah. So now that maybe doesn't sound so glamorous, but to me, I love that kind of thing. I love this sort of, every Hollywood is so, everything's big budget and everyone thinks it's this thing but there's live performance going on of all stripes. And it's really nice to hear like, oh yeah, we were driving around in our cars doing these road shows.
28 states and I don't know what, 7 months, 8 months. So anyway, I did that. And then I really wanted more training. I was influenced by some of the people at Catholic U, and they were saying, especially at that time, the best training is going to be in Britain.
Yeah. Now, this is what I wanted to get into, because I read that you were with the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yep. And so I went to I auditioned for the Royal Academy of Music Dramatic Art, mm-hmm. and the London Academy, and the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. Actually, RADA's the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and I was accepted by both. But Lambda, the London, had a 1-year postgraduate course, and mm-hmm. since I had a degree, I had all this sort of thing.
Lots of school.
I wanted to get some more training, but I didn't want to spend the rest of my life on the edge of the swimming pool. So
right.
I went to Lambda, did that year course, and then it was like, okay, now what do I do? And I decided if I was going to starve to death, I would rather starve to death in England than in New York, because I went over to New York and it was just overwhelming, because basically I had been trained as an English actor, not the pushy, everybody's going to be a star mentality that I was in, you know, getting in New York.
So. Right. Can you speak to that a little bit? I have a theater degree, and I, growing up and listening to the people that were teaching and mentors, it was very much the sort of understanding that it was very difficult for an American to go to England and have any level of success as an actor.
Well,
it seems like Brits come here and
now, not so much, but then, but yeah, I by various hooks and by crooks, I was able to work there under laws that existed in Britain before they joined the common market, mm-hmm. which meant that if you had an ancestry, a British ancestry, there was the possibility that you were still connected.
They'd take you as one of their own.
Yeah, that you could prove that you had real British roots, et cetera, et cetera. So I did.
Okay.
Got a lawyer and went through it all.
Oh, wow.
So I was able to stay there. But then I thought, I've just been to this drama school. And one of the interesting things with British training or with this training was learning that I didn't put on an English accent.
Oh.
I lost my American.
Okay.
The understanding that, okay, they don't have an accent, you do.
Right, that makes sense.
So the switch in mind was such that I became very, very fluent. And so I could go ahead and audition through the British system, mm-hmm. which was that at that time you needed to do 40 weeks of work outside of London. There were two classifications of Equity Card. One was a red card, which was not temporary, but it was a provisional.
Okay.
And you needed to get 40 weeks of work outside of London, which meant you had to probably get into the repertory system.
Sure.
At that time, there were approximately 100 repertory theaters outside of London. So it was a question of auditioning, and they could only take 2 people, by the way, at each
So odds are low.
So anyway, I auditioned, and I started at the Nottingham Playhouse. And then I went to Derby Rep, where I put in quite a bit of time. That was fun. It was a new play every 2 weeks, and it was very interesting to be in plays that you were right for, wrong for, sort of for.
Whatever they
wanted, hoping that more people would be in the theater than the drunk sitting on the steps outside. And
do you look back at that fondly?
I do. I mean, I was as a friend of mine, David Suchet, the actor who plays Poirot.
Sure.
He and I shared a dressing room at Stratford a little later on, and he was talking to his mother, and she was saying, "Oh, during we in the 40s, we went dancing and we did this and we and he said, "Mother, that's during the Blitz. They were bombing. A war was raging above your head." And she said, "Yes, dear, but we were young." And I was young.
So, right.
It was very challenging. I'm very grateful for it,
mm-hmm.
because you pick up a lot of skills.
Right.
I mean, nobody has a monopoly on talent. No country has a monopoly on acting talent.
No, that's certainly true.
But the British train actors, with that, I mean, you've heard it a dozen times, the old Noel Coward dictum of when the young actor asked him, "Sir Noel, what should I do?" And he said, "Speak up so we can hear you and don't trip over the furniture." And that's how they train you. They
sure.
work on your voice. They work on your body. They give you texts. You learn how to handle text and mm-hmm. words and enjoy words and all
yeah.
of that. Instead of worrying about your motivation, it's uh-huh. it's much more practical.
Yes.
And then you have to go out and get experience. You get enough experience, maybe you're worth hiring.
Right.
So that's how the British system worked. And British actors still have more opportunity to work than American actors.
Certainly, yeah.
So anyway, I did the rep thing.
What brought you back to the States and launched sort of, I mean, that's a heaping helping of live performance.
Yeah. I've actually done close to 100 professional plays.
Wow. So then you're,
but
your television and film resume, that you're no slouch there either.
Well, what happened was that I got more and more interested in film and television.
Sure.
I went into the Royal Shakespeare Company because that was one of the things I really wanted to do.
You had your sights set on it.
And I had just done quite a good part in what's now quite a famous British television series called Cold It. And my agents were all excited because there's money in television, there's money in film, mm-hmm. and there's not a lot in the theater. But I was determined to do the RSC. And I got in to the RSC because I also sing, or I sang. And I was able to convince them that I was far grander and better trained singer because they wanted a couple of the parts sung like an operatic aria.
Okay.
And play the parts I had in the company too. But anyway, I got into the RSC. I did my almost 3 years and I was thrilled with that. And I came out then I was promptly unemployed for 11 months. the greatest company in the world and you
as
sitting
it.
There waiting for your British equivalent of unemployment and wondering if you're going to eat the next day.
Sure.
So I came out of the RSC and I was, again, so interested in film and television because Alan Parker, Sir Alan Parker, mm-hmm. Now, he was the king of British commercials back then.
Okay.
And I started doing commercials for him.
In England still?
In England, yeah.
Okay.
And I started doing commercials for him and interesting, of course, with the RSC, they got a big chuckle out of the fact when we went on our first tour, which was over here, mm-hmm. and I handed in an American passport. He said, "Oh, you're American." They were very amused by it because I had no idea. I'd been with the company a year.
Yeah.
If somebody from Sanford, Arizona can play Shakespeare in Shakespeare's hometown with the Royal Shakespeare Company, you've got a pretty good accent.
Yeah. It really truly does speak to that sort of the it doesn't really flow that way much.
No,
Americans
no,
do
no.
not go and have the experience that you had. It's really a marvelous thing.
So I was delighted that happened. But Alan started putting me in commercials and I was playing quintessential Englishman. I was the cliche Englishman.
Oh, wow.
And he would cast me in commercial after commercial. Well, at a certain point, one very dreary around Christmas time, winter, and of course, as usual, I was unemployed. And
the best time to be unemployed.
the casting director said, "Come on down. We want you to audition for this part for Alan Parker in this commercial." And so I threw on some clothes and was out the door. When Alan was told I was coming in, he said to Joyce Golly, who was the casting director, mm-hmm. "Why are you sending me Michael? This is American part. Michael's too..."
Oh, he had no idea either?
So I went in and I read for one of Howard Hughes' Mormon Mafia. They were serializing the Howard Hughes story in the Sunday Express.
Okay.
And they were doing vignettes from that. And so it had... dramatization of Howard Hughes and these guys, this Mormon mafia around him. And so I went in and read for Alan. He says, "How can you do that? Why you do that?" And then I explained, right. So there I was.
Right.
Well, that directly led to So much stuff.
I know, a lot of connective tissue. I know.
I was doing a very interesting play because it was so interesting to. There's one of the late Tennessee Williams plays called The Red Devil Battery Sign. And a friend of mine, Estelle Kohler, was the star in it. And she said, "Darling, there's a part in there. You must come and audition." And I said, "Well, okay." She says, "It's a horrible play. It's not very good, but Tennessee is here. He's actually here all through the rehearsal period and is with us." So I thought, how many times can you be in a play with Tennessee Williams there?
Right.
Doing it. Of his plays. So anyway, I got in. And I was doing that play in the West End at the Phoenix Theater. And Alan rang up between the matinee and evening one day and said, "Michael, I'm doing this movie called Midnight Express, and I've written a part in it for you. You want to do it?" I said, "Of course."
Right.
He said, I know, mate, but you're doing this play. I mean, what if you – I said, I'll be –
I'll make
said,
it work.
"Alan, I'll burn the theater down. I'll be there." And then, of course, it did close before I had to be on location in Malta with Midnight Express.
Uh-huh.
And it was an American part, and it was due directly to what I'd done in that – those commercials.
Right, right.
So I played this Stanley Daniels, who was the American consul who keeps trying to get the Billy Hayes character out, played by Brad Davis, out of prison. So I went down there. It was really wonderful experience.
Was it wildly different from the stage experience? It seems to me, I'm getting you just had oodles of stage time. Through the years. Is that your first?
It was the first big movie. I had learned a lot. Again, Alan taught me a lot through commercials.
Yeah, that's not easy work.
And when I did Colditz, because I had quite a lot of credits even then at 28, the first day of filming, I wasn't needed. My scenes weren't being shot until the afternoon. Mm-hmm. But I went out to the location and watched like a hawk what they were doing.
Right, right, right.
And then
learn a lot just
when,
by
when
being a fly
I
on
was
the wall.
Up in front, I only blew one take, and they were asking me to exit camera left, and I went right because I was thinking stage right and stage left. And,
sure.
But anyway, I had had some of that experience. But when I got on to the to Midnight Express, It was interesting because back in the olden days, they had to ship the film up to London to be processed, and then he couldn't see the dailies.
Oh wow!
And there was a 3-day lag, and so I sweated it out because they were one of the last days of filming. I know Alan, and he doesn't do many takes, and he was going over and over again with this two-hander with me and Brad.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, no,
he's not getting it.
Get what he wants.
Yeah.
I'm in trouble. But 3 days later, he said, "I should have trusted you. It was all in your eyes. You were doing what I wanted."
Right.
So anyway, the movie was released. I was doing – right after the movie, I went into the West End and I did 18 months in the musical Irene as the leading man in the West End.
You're a busy fellow at this time.
I was. What happened? Who stopped the truck?
It doesn't seem like
it
stopped.
Who turned the lights on and could see actually what it was?
Well, if you don't mind, I would like to jump forward.
Sure.
If this is all the appetizer for the T-bone steak, that is Ghostbusters. That is the film I want.
Ghostbusters.
That's the film I want to concentrate on.
That's what you can cut everything to this.
No, okay. No.
the rest of it's just
I'm totally,
an old actor talking too much.
I'm totally enthralled by all of that stuff because I do think it is a monumental achievement to go across the pond and work as an American in Britain for as long as you did.
A Brit.
Yeah, right. Nobody knew you're hiding in plain sight. So practically speaking, where do you think you were in your career when Ghostbusters came?
The movie that brought – because Midnight Express was up for an Academy Award.
Right.
Was nominated for Best Picture. And my quick little Hollywood story is that on Oscar night, I was in my tacky North Hollywood apartment with Motel 6 furniture, ironing a shirt in my underwear,
right,
and watching the Oscars on a rented black and white TV. And then on the screen came a two-hander scene between me and Brad Davis, mm-hmm, representing the picture.
Wow.
So there was the Hollywood glamour. There was the whole story.
And that
So, and it didn't win, but it I got my revenge later because Titanic did. I'm in a member of the Academy, so there.
take that. You know?
So anyway, I that's what brought me over. I was called in to audition for Ghostbusters, and I originally auditioned for the William Atherton part.
Oh,
the,
sure.
The guy from the EPA. And the had me back twice for that.
The part that ruined his life.
Yeah, and they should have given it to me. But I went in twice on that. My agents were excited about it. I was excited about it. We thought that we were going to just ask. And then if, later on, it, so the story was told me that William Atherton had a deal with the studio and they had to use him in so many pictures.
Gotcha.
And that was one they assigned. So I went home and cried. And much later on, the phone rang. And they said, do you want a booby prize? You want a consolation prize?
Right.
And I said, sure. Come down and play this hotel manager for us.
Right.
So I went down to the Biltmore Hotel here in Los Angeles. And a very, very long night. They filmed what would normally have taken 3 days, but they were running out of money and running out of time.
Yeah.
So they were crowding that all in one mammoth filming session.
I was going to ask you that exact question of how long did it take? And it's so we're, are we talking just 6 p.m. till they're done?
Till it was light and they had to, you know, give up their location because it is a functioning hotel.
Yeah.
But that's how I got that. And oddly enough, because of the great success of Ghostbusters, it really did help my career, even though it's quite a, I mean, it's not quite in Britain, they, about a small part, they say it's a spit and a cough. And but it's certainly more than that.
Oh, I think it's a fantastic scene. And that's what this show's all about is actors that are present for these scenes that you can't forget in these giant movies. So I do want to ask you this. At any point during that epic night that you were shooting, did you feel like you were part of a thing?
I was under tremendous pressure.
Okay.
First of all, because they were going and Ivan was not in a good mood. And there's a long shot where I greet them at the door.
Yes.
And I'm talking to them and walking, we're talking, we have, and there was a turn that had to be made so that we ended up at the doors of the ballroom.
Right.
And there were a number of camera moves and cues that were cued off of that dialogue. So I'm very professional, know all my words.
Right.
And I'm there and I'm going and suddenly what they're saying bears no resemblance to anything that I saw on the printed page.
Okay.
And they were making up stuff and having fun and doing all this kind of stuff and it would blow and it would blow take after take.
Sure.
Because I had to be sure, oh, okay, now maybe I better throw my line in here, but I was certainly not getting the cues. And so finally, Ivan really blew up at me.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, no, and I can't turn around and say, well, blow up at your stars because they're the reason.
Yeah, I mean, I've read several accounts that Bill Murray doesn't say a line in the script. He's making up everything as he goes.
And that's what Bill Murray, and it was either Bill Murray or Dan, who said, you know, back off, Ivan. Don't blame him. We're doing it.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's nice to hear.
So they stepped up and saved me.
Because you're under immense pressure. It's not only one thing with the lines, but that the moving and not – there's so many moving parts that an audience, a film-going audience doesn't see that it just takes a little thing for them to have to go, nope, go back. We have to start over.
And that's a lot of reset for those that kind of scene that was so complicated. Like
right.
I said, they were trying to condense into one night what – could easily have taken 3 days.
Right, right.
To shoot.
So in that opening scene, I rewatched the film last night, and I watched your scenes very closely because there were some things I thought when you watch under this microscope, you see things that maybe you hadn't seen before in the film. I've seen Ghostbusters dozens of times. Bill Murray is sort of manhandling you as you walk down the hall in the final cut. That seemed very. Just an extension of him improvising lines and words. It seemed very much like you weren't expecting that from him.
I wasn't expecting it, but I usually, I'm a character actor.
Right.
So the character, whatever he did to me, would have to have the character reacting as the character does.
Oh, and you do such a good job of reacting to him.
So yeah. that's what came into play on that.
Uh huh.
I got along fine with them. I subsequently worked with Dan Aykroyd again on The Couch Trip.
Yes.
He's very nice, by the way.
Sure.
Just a really super guy.
How much – so in just in that opening scene where you're walking and you end up at the elevators, was there a deleted scene or is there stuff on the cutting room floor between that? Because it seems like it cuts pretty abruptly. It's almost like you drop them off at the elevator and then it's there's the guy chomping on a cigar and they talk about the cockroach on the 12th floor. Do you have any recollection of that?
Probably. Or? It was, that was, 75 pounds ago when I had hair.
And I can relate too, it's work and you're probably so dialed in that you can't remember. I have a terrible time recalling happened on those days.
I remember some of it. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed. I love working. I'm one of those actors that, despite what we've just been talking about,
right?
I don't like talking about it,
sure.
And I don't like the show busy aspect of it.
Yeah,
but I love the doing of it.
Absolutely.
So that's why I'm still an actor after 47 years.
Sure.
Because that's what I love.
Is this character based on anybody, or does the character have a name? It's such an uppity, uptight person, right?
He is up. He is. And boy, did I pay a price for that. From then on, I would get all sorts of.
That's your offer.
Prissy little men in bow ties with a mustache. That's what would come my way.
Right.
Again, that British training. He was very much a British character, an English character without the accent.
Right.
Without being British.
Right. I mean, it.
But a sense of decorum, sense of purpose.
Yes.
Worried about the image of the hotel.
Everything has to be shipshape.
It has to be right. We don't want to have a bad impression with things. And so that all translates to a character along with people who are, nuts.
Right. But I think you say it's a small part, but I think it's the first time in the film because I've rewatched it again, like I said, and Bill Murray is really a creep. In the movie. I mean, if you choose to watch it that way and just, he's hitting on the woman with the psychology test and any female that walks by, he's relentlessly hitting on them. And that's fine. I mean, it's just as good a character choice as any, but he treats everybody pretty poorly on just a base level. And I think you're the first character that Peter Venkman encounters that you sort of give him, you stand up to him a bit. There's definitely I want this done and I want it done right. Like that shines through in these scenes. So then just some practical questions that I have for you. When they're in there shooting they're capturing the ghost. You're checking the door and there's the scene with the woman where I assure you it'll be all fine. Just practically speaking, there's no noise going on. Are you reacting to somebody yelling and the table flips over, or are you reacting to actual?
As I recall, there wasn't that. They just told me that there's you're hearing all of this stuff,
right? And now you hear a table get flipped over.
And that it was more that they weren't actually doing nice things for me like that.
There's one thing I noticed for the first time ever is Onion Head. Does that ring a bell? I guess the ghost Slimer that everyone knows as Slimer was originally written as Onion Head, and he was supposed to be this stinky, smelly ghost. And so when Dan Aykroyd comes out with the trap and the smoke is coming off of it, grab your handkerchief and cover your nose because
the stench.
That's a directed choice?
They said this thing
smells horrible.
It's just terrible smell.
So just practically speaking as an actor, the handkerchief switches hands at one point, which maybe drives you crazy. I'm not sure if that does or not. But any time I'm working as an actor, I always think, how are my hands? Does that factor in for you just on a nuts and bolts level? Do you worry about that kind of stuff?
I do if it's vital. Do worry about it. I try to always get it right. But the thing that I do with especially film mm-hmm. – I mean, stage, you rehearse and rehearse, rehearse, rehearse so that you can do it 8 times a week and make it look like it's happening for the first time. With film, you're providing moments. And so when they say action, I try to blot my mind mm-hmm. and just enter in to that moment.
Right.
And rely on what the stimuli is coming from the other actors or the situation. And I'm not as technical mm-hmm. as if we had rehearsed it forever. And,
right.
You know, it's probably just a mistake on my part.
Well, it's clear like there's a cut at some point and that it's in editing and they figure you won't notice. And I've seen it dozens of times. I never noticed it. But there's a handkerchief thing that's going on and it's fine. It doesn't detract from the film. But I just worked on a project where I was handcuffed. And I thought every time we were shooting, I thought, well, what did I do with my hands?
Right.
It's such a weird thing to think about. But
I hate props. I tell anytime I'm on a set, no props.
Yeah,
I do a silly little recurring thing on a show called Kirby Buckets. And it's a Disney Channel thing.
Uh-huh.
And they love to try to give me stuff because a lot of actors love all the toys.
Right.
And I don't. I would rather just keep my hands beside me. Then I know where they are.
Right.
And I don't have to worry about where I put that and how I put that and
right.
all the rest of it. So I'm one of these people who are minimal props. And maybe that's why
you
see me screwing up a hanky.
I love the scene, and I do think it sets the tone for the film. I just think it's a fantastic – I mean, it's the first ghost they capture. It legitimizes the business. And when he asks you for the $5,000, that very snooty, "I won't pay it," is just sublime. It's fantastic.
Well, it's interesting. When I did two movies that same time.
Uh-huh.
One was All of Me.
Yes.
With Steve Martin and Lily Tomlin. And when I read the script, I laughed out loud. I thought it was so funny.
Yeah.
I read Ghostbusters and I went, huh? And then my agent came with me and we saw Ghostbusters at a cast and crew screening. And we came out saying, it's okay.
Right.
You know, nothing. Both of us sort of thought it was, yeah, okay. Then I took my godsons, who were quite young, to see it in Westwood.
Uh-huh.
And we get there and there's a line around the block. And then we go up there, and they spotted me in the line immediately, knew exactly who I was and what I played, and went in. And then suddenly people are, like Rocky Horror Picture Show, shouting out lines before the characters can say it.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, okay, I really missed this one.
Is it that must happen a lot, I think. You know, you just never know what you're working on, how it'll be critically received.
Oh, sure.
And I think maybe I'm speaking for you here, but I can certainly say to me, I think it's – you've sort of said it already. As an actor, you just want to do the work.
Mm.
And it's the audience's job to receive it however they receive it. And that seems like the case. I mean, again, I think your performance in this film is really funny. And it's really grounded, and it helps legitimize the main characters of the film in a way that – is fantastic.
Well, it actually got me a lot of work.
Yeah, and I want to do some quick – we have a little bit of time left, so I want to have some quick questions about some of your other work. Let's talk about Titanic. How much water are you still finding in your body?
Well, something happened to the digestion. That was very, very interesting because I auditioned for that, but I never met James Cameron. Mally Finn, who's no longer with us, was the casting director, and she was determined I was going to play that part. So I came in and I auditioned on tape,
mm-hmm.
and then Cameron spoke about it and then auditioned again so they could have it. And finally, I got the part, but he had never met me. And then I got down to Rosarito, and it was like 10 and a half weeks of location.
Right.
Being held in a velvet prison, a resort,
right,
where we were, and it was by this point that was what 20 years ago, but I've done a lot of work up before that,
right.
So it wasn't like it was a new game, but I've never been in anything that had that kind of scale to it. One night
sure.
we had 1,500 extras.
Oh,
on the set.
That's unbelievable.
And and then the night that we were going to do the big. Sinking of the ship and all of that, the night before, Cameron called me down to the set and said, Michael, how do you feel about stunts? And I said, James, I am a coward, religious in it. In fact, my family coat of arms is a sheep running away. And he laughed. And so I was taken care of. But it was a very they did as much as they could for safety, but it was always going to be a little out of control because, again, if we had not got that set done on that night, to reset it would have taken, I believe, 5 weeks.
Right, because it's pretty much to reset abject destruction.
Everything again. So it was a lot of pressure. And there were some things they couldn't determine. And with my scene, where I'm coming down the stairs and
asking for a brandy.
And he says, no, we've dressed in our best and prepared to go down like gentlemen, but we would like a brandy. That's my line. I made that.
Oh, nice.
Cameron said, we need something to get you over to Astor because there's a scene that's missing.
Yes.
He said, well, ask him for a drink. So, but we would like a brandy was my little contribution.
I love it. I love it.
And it was because of that, I think it stayed in the picture because when they started cutting stuff, he was going to try, there was talk of cutting that whole sequence.
Right.
And the stills photographer, and I'm blanking on her name, she was lovely. She went to Cameron and had a little fit. She said, that's one of the famous lines that has come down through history that was real in Titanic. Guggenheim actually said that because
oh, wow.
His steward was one of the last people they put on one of the boats leaving the boat because they needed an extra sailor.
It's also like a moment of humanity.
Yeah, and he reported back to what Guggenheim was doing during that period of time.
Right.
And that was one of the famous lines. The other thing that we didn't shoot, I hope that Cameron would do it, was another famous line of his where they're lowering the boat with this Johnson, this guy in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, tell my wife I played the game straight to the end and that no woman's life was lost because Ben Guggenheim was a coward. Because by that time, people were getting the boats.
Yeah.
Men. So, it was, I really liked working with Cameron.
Sure.
You don't get a chance to work with a genius very often in this life.
Right.
And he is. But he has an absolute laser beam focus. And you need to get in on that.
Get in his zone.
Get in the zone. Go with it. Do not challenge it.
Yeah.
Do not try to divert from it. And you're fine. If you do, he's an equal opportunity
insulter.
Use the words. But he will not tolerate it.
Oh, wow.
So I could spot that. I've worked with a lot of directors. As long as they're really good and doing great work, I'm a sucker for talent.
Right. I want to ask you about Superman. I mean, it's quick. I just want – if you have anything that comes to mind when I say Superman.
It was really interesting because that was one of the last things I did before I left to England to come back over here.
Uh-huh.
And myself and another guy, we would go out to the studio and they took us in for a number of days. And we were actually being shot with the B unit. But we're still on the same stage with the A.
Sure,
so
yeah,
the final
sense.
Day, we went up to the director, which is Richard Donner, is it?
Yes.
Went up to him and said, you know, just saying thank you and shake his hand.
Right.
And he's looking at us.
Who are you?
Who are you? How did you get on the stage? But the naughty thing about – or not naughty, but something that was a problem with that was that for Superman 2 – they were using footage from the first one.
Oh, no.
With trying to get away with it.
Right.
And fortunately, I believe British Equity went to battle and got that changed.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether some of mine might have, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. I want to ask you about the wall.
Well,
I mean,
this is Alan Parker again.
Alan Parker connection.
See, Alan put me in all his commercials and – when I left England and after Midnight Express, I said, Alan, if you ever need me, just call me. I'll be here. And I don't need to talk about money, anything. Just if you need me, tell me what time to show up.
Oh, that's so neat.
So he called me from London and said, Michael, I need you here in, 10 days out at the studio. I said, good, I'll be there. And he had taken over the wall because Michael Sarrazin, who was the – his lighting cameraman, his cinematographer. Mm-hmm. This was going to be his, I believe, first director thing.
Yeah.
And Alan was just producing it. And it came back that, at least what I was told, that the studio wouldn't approve it with Michael. They had to have Alan direct it. So Alan had to take it over. And it was fun because they used to pick – Alan was a great one for sending cars to pick up people because he knew that was the way you guarantee somebody is on time and in there.
That's funny.
You get them there.
Right.
So the car that would come and collect me was Bob Geldof's car.
Oh,
so
wow.
I got to ride out with him every morning for about 45 minutes in the car.
Yeah.
And got to know him a little bit and immense respect for him. Very, very, very smart man.
He seems intense.
Very intense, but very well-educated.
That's wonderful.
A real intellectual.
Here's another one. Now, I don't remember this at all, but my mother will tell you that I would plant myself in front of the television and could not be disturbed when the Dukes of Hazzard was on. Do you remember anything about this?
Oh, yes.
It's a two-parter.
Yes,
I don't remember it. So I kind of want to go back and watch.
I can't remember exactly. I think I'm a crooked politician.
Undercover Dukes, yeah. Parts 1 and 2.
I think I play a lot of second villain. And that was another one of those second villain roles.
Okay.
And I play a lot of red herring roles where
you think you're the bad guy,
but actually he's not, and they shoot me too early on in the picture. but it was
well,
fun.
You clearly made it to part two.
Yeah, it was fun, and I remember being on location somewhere in this house that we were filming in, and I know a little bit about antique furniture and stuff, and I was looking at this secretary desk, and I thought, wow, this is really good. And then I checked it, and it was real Chinese Thomas Chippendale from the 18th century, practically priceless.
Wow, and they're
and
using it
part
on
part of the Warner Brothers, set of props.
They're using it on the set of Hazzard County.
Yeah, Hazzard County. And I, you know, I again, all of this stuff is fun.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt
and,
about it.
And Dukes is. Factors into so many little kids' heritage.
Yeah, certainly mine. What about Golden Girls?
Well, that was fun too. what wasn't fun? Let me think about it. That was great because, first of all, it was a well-established show, and I was the only, and Terry Hughes, the director, mm-hmm. has been so good to me through my career. He's English. He's a wonderful guy, and. He put me in that, and great fun playing another one of Blanche's trashy boyfriends.
Right.
And what was interesting about it was that by this point, those women pretty much had become their character.
Right.
You had them, they were off stage, and when they were greeted, you know, it was just like they were filming it. They had all become very much those characters.
Well, and I think that's sort of capturing lightning in a bottle for actors and actresses is if you find a role that fits you like a good – like an old pair of shoes, like something that's just – it's you at the core. And maybe you push it out a little bit as an actor or you rein it in a little bit. But if the personality of the character matches who you are in real life in a way, I think that's really where people shine.
By that point, they have.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was very interesting because they would – when we'd rehearse, then they'd go off to their little bungalows, except for Betty. Betty is magnificent. Betty would stay on the set. Betty would keep on the set knitting, and I'd sit down and talk to her, and we had great chats while the other gals were gone.
Sure.
One of the rehearsals, I knock on the door. Blanche opens and says, Donald, and I come in. Well, we did it a couple of times, and she wasn't happy. She was complaining. And I thought, wait a minute. I'm used to getting compliments, not – criticism. And then I said, okay. I went against the director's instruction. And when she knocked on the door, she opened and said, Donald, I came in. I walked downstage. I turned with my back to the equivalent of the audience and the camera.
Right.
And played the scene that way. And then she was happy. And I said, nobody except my mother and a couple other people are going to tune into this show because I'm on it. They're tuning in to see these gals.
Right, right.
I mean, it worked out. I mean, they were all nice. B was kind of difficult. She wouldn't speak to me. but then I realized, and I'll give her credit for this, and I mean, she's gone now, but apparently she was very hard of hearing.
Oh.
So when I would come in and say, good morning, Miss Arthur, unless she was maybe looking at me, she probably didn't even hear me.
Wow. Yeah.
And the rest of them, but Betty. Betty I worked with later on in that short-lived Marie Osmond thing, mm-hmm. and then on Boston Legal. But that yeah. woman, with all the people she's met and everything that she's had in her life, I hadn't seen her for years. And I walk on the set, and she said, hi, Michael.
That's
and
lovely.
Knew me and knew where we had worked together, and I was touched, but so impressed.
Yeah, yeah.
That this now very old lady who's had years and years and years of experience and thousands of people that she's worked and met would remember me and remember my name.
I think that's as sweet a place to end it as ever. Michael, is there anything that you are either currently working on or something that you've done in your career that you wished more people would check out? I guess that's two separate questions. Are you working on anything currently? What can we look for you in, if anything?
Obituaries.
Well, what about – is there anything you've done in your career that you think, oh, I'd like to get some more eyeballs on that? It's fine if that's – the answer is no, there isn't.
I don't know. There's – again, I like things that are a little more obscure. I'm enough of an English actor. I like very subtle things. Mm-hmm. There have been things on television that that I wish that a few more people had seen.
Sure.
But on feature films that I really felt strongly about, I think honestly the some of the earliest stuff like Midnight Express.
Midnight Express.
I think Midnight. I watched it not long ago, and I think it holds up pretty good.
I'm certainly guilty of not having seen it, so I think that's what I'll be watching this weekend.
It still holds up.
I love it, Michael. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.